have with us on Pentimental today, Thomas Brown. Thomas has been a guest on Always Record, and other people might know him from his work with the Borderlands Research Institute, as well as his more recent work on videos on YouTube dealing with stuff like Quaternity and Four Worlds Theory. So Tom is really a godfather, I would say, of the psychonautics movement, but I will also let him introduce himself first. So Tom, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, well, thank you, John and Tom. I look forward to a good conversation here.
So yeah, why don't you just like give us a little bit more about your background in case anyone's listening that, again, hasn't heard of you or isn't as familiar with your work as we are or other people might be.
Okay, well, I guess my background is in general, just a self-taught person, but I was very fortunate in circumstances in my life. And along the way, back in the 1980s, I ended up as a director of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, which I took over from Riley Crabb, who was a friend of mine. I was just a collector of old books, and I was buying up all the old books he was publishing on, you know, lecture series on UFOs and the Kabbalah and radionics and subjects like that. And just somehow circumstances happened that I just took over and started running it, which I never expected to do. And then when I did that, I started meeting people like Trevor Constable and Eric Dollard, some of the people at the real forefront of alternative energies and actually making them work, very practical sort of experimenters. So yeah, I did that for about 10 years, did about 50 issues of the Journal of Borderland Research, published about 200 reprints of old science books and, you know, new things that people had written. Produced a few videos. Nature Was My Teacher, which has had probably 150,000 plus views over the years on YouTube, if you can count on their counters. That's just adding up from the various sites it's been posted, because I don't get any royalties. I've always given everything away for free, you know, other than magazine subscriptions. And then moved to New Zealand in the mid-90s and just got involved in various businesses here, dietary supplements and nootropics, things like that. A few years back, I started getting back into this alternative work and started producing what I call symbolic performance art. And that was, like you mentioned, the video Quaternity, which was sort of my first production in that series. And then the last one I did was called Dorje Blessing, which is basically on Tibetan symbolism. And those are sort of laying the groundwork for the upcoming work that I'm putting together at this point.
You're further developing the video series, or you're thinking of doing a book, or what's your plan?
Well, I keep thinking of a book, but I never get around to writing it, even though I probably, you know, write thousands of words on posts here and there on various forums and Facebook and things like that. But I seem to collect my thoughts better when I'm speaking. But one of the things I've learned over the years is because, well, I had rather poor eyesight through most of my life. So when Riley Crabb talked me into going out and lecturing because I was studying the Kabbalah and various subjects, you know, Tesla's work. And so he encouraged me to lecture. So what I found is, you know, I'd write out a speech, you know, like I would learn in speech class in high school, and I would stand in front of people and I couldn't read it, you know, because I'd try to get eye contact with them and I couldn't. It was too hard for me. So I started developing what you would call visual aids, you know, originally just posters and just drawing out trees of life and then and now known erroneous concepts of Tesla's broadcast electricity and things. But I found visual props work quite well. And as time would go on, I would get asked to give a talk at a conference and publishing books and magazine. And I just would never had the time to really prepare. You know, I'd have to fill an hour. So I'd slap like 120 slides together. And I just figured I'd just go through them and tell a story. But I noticed something in the process of doing that. And I would cover everything from invisible UFOs that Trevor Constable took pictures of in infrared film, on through Goethe's theory of color, you know, Tesla's broadcast electricity, archetypal structures, alchemy. I'd sort of cover everything I could in a short time trying to put all pieces together into a sort of a larger picture. And what I noticed out of that at the end of these lectures is people were actually quite excited, and everybody, like, I get like 25% of the room raising their hands right away. And they didn't want to really ask me questions so much as they wanted to tell me about what it was in their lives that opened them up to this greater sort of understanding of things outside of status quo reality. So I sort of developed that into an art where I just sort of like lay out all these images, and it didn't matter what story I told on top. You know, I tried to make it as coherent and accurate as I could, but underlying it was always this flow of symbols. And that's why I developed into these, what I call a symbolic performance art. So I'm still working on that, trying to develop it a bit more to actually create psychoactive states and give people awareness of higher realities just by watching these things.
Yeah, no, I think at least that's part of my motive here too. It's using the medium of, communication and dialogue to create a piece of art that, same way you'd go and look at in a museum, and it would make you really ponder either yourself or the world you're in or whatever, your connection to the cosmos. In the same way, a good dialogue or even a good focus video like you do with like Quaternity, where you tether together all these symbols and concepts that people would never even think to bring together in the first place on their own, or might, but might think they're a little too crazy for their own good and might not really take it too far. So you lend a voice to that in a lot of ways. And really, yeah, I think the psychedelic experience and art go hand in hand.
I'm very happy that the conversation initially took that direction of symbols as language, because obviously that's the big strength of what you're doing now with your performance art. And, you know, I think that even as we speak verbally, a lot of the times we don't, in our very specific way of speaking our language, we don't always get the same, we don't always understand each other in the same way as what the speaker intends. So, you know, in searching for a new language of symbols, you could take advantage of that ambiguity. So it was nice for me to hear you talk about your slideshows. But again, on this topic of symbolism in a densely symbolic world of the psychedelic experience, you know, I'd really like to hear your thoughts and your interpretation of the psychedelic experience as being just a totally different world, and, you know, what your interpretation of that is.
Certainly. I haven't had a few psychedelic experiences, both induced and natural through life. What I find is, well, I liken it to Shulgin. I had a taped lecture of his years ago on what he called the Ma Bell theory of psychedelics. He likened them, he said, to telephones, you know, when they came out with the touch tone phones, you know, because some of us remember the old dial ones. And, you know, you have your basic, you know, grid there of the 3x4, you know, with the 10 numbers and the two. So you have your 12 buttons. But he said that would be like a regular neurotransmitter, like serotonin or dopamine or whatever. But then, like, if you go into, like, in the military or government offices, there'd be another 4 buttons down. So you'd have 16 buttons there, he said. And then using those, you could access, like, all these other places, you know, the secret places that you couldn't access with the other numbers. So he likened the psychedelics as like higher order neurotransmitters. They were like these extra 4 buttons on the phone, so you could dial into these higher spaces. So I believe I kind of come from the school of thought that the psychedelics are nothing more than something that we actually create them in our own system. And I believe we do it probably more often than realized, you know, through meditation and things. And you get these sort of higher kind of concepts of awareness at times, and possibly even during modes of synchronicity or deja vu. It could very well be alteration of the neurotransmitters, which of course then makes one wonder is consciousness real, or is it some chemical thing depending on the shape of these molecules in our brain, which we don't know. But as far as psychedelic in itself, you know, I think for the most people it'd be a step outside their normal state of reality. I never saw them as any sort of answer to anything, but more as, we could say, guides or teachers to show us higher states that we're able to actually create within ourselves. And, of course, that's really what I've been thinking out. How can I do that with my art and knowledge and sciences? Actually create these states in people just by, you know, sort of cogitating on a storyline as they're watching a stream of symbols.
Yeah. And that really is the heart of synchronicity, right? And like you just mentioned it. And I love the quote from your longtime friend and Vince Gaddis. Is that correct?
Correct.
Am I getting that name right? And he said that one of the three things, or one of the two things he wanted to know before he passed, was like, what is the mystery of synchronicity? I mean, that a man who researched mysteries for his life, mm-hmm. that was the greatest one to him.
Exactly. Because he said that, you know, that showed that things weren't just like straight line, that there was some other higher order mechanism operating behind everything.
Yeah. And then the question then becomes, right, where is the line between, where does the psychedelic experience end and where does it begin? I mean, is our waking life a psychedelic experience? I mean, we're getting a usual dosage of certain chemicals that are keeping us in equilibrium and we see reality in a certain way. But then through, say, even an emotionally jarring incident, people could have something like a near-death experience. Like, you don't even have to be near death to enter into these kind of initiatory trances almost, where you either get a life review or something is made very clear to you. And I think there's many different vectors to that kind of revelation or similar revelation. But the question is, it is interesting to say, ask, you know, yeah, we can use plants or whatever as catalysts. But then the question is, are those, again, what's the human capable of without them? And then what can we do to, again, people that don't have access to plants for both legal reasons or financial reasons or whatever, right? How can they get into these kinds of states or these kinds of just headspace, you know, to kind of like understand the logic of it? If there is even a logic, maybe there isn't, but so creating art and interesting kind of gateways for people to get into this subject matter, I think is like what kind of motivates me, because like I'm not cultivating any psychoactive substances for people, but I can definitely put shit on the internet and see what happens with it. So I can at least do that much. And I think that's kind of what we're all doing in our way.
Oh, exactly. Well, as we know, I mean, there's thousands of people flocking like every month down to South America to do their ayahuasca experience. And some people, it's life changing and amazing. And other, I've talked to people that have gone down and spent a lot of time and they're going, man, I'm like so over this. You know, it's like, I thought something big would happen. He says, yeah, you were just like tripping and puking. And so it's different for everybody. And that's what I want to kind of show. I've tried to find this stuff out. I mean, all my life has been a search, I could say, for the psychedelic experience, but not in a drug-induced sense, more in,
sure,
in the sense of, that's why I was always interested in, like, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, Western occultism. You know, I went through Theosophy, Rudolf Steiner's Anthroposophy. Looked into the Eastern, you know, Shinto, Vajrayana, different sort of levels of Buddhism. I was always seeking out something. I was never really sure what. And now I kind of understand what I was seeking out, and I feel sort of settled in where I'm going with it, even though I know I still have a lot to learn. But I could say in general, I generally live in what most people would consider a psychedelic state, mm-hmm, in, you know, my sort of worldview.
Yeah.
And of course, I thought you should throw in too. I mean, I've actually met people, I've got a couple of friends that have gone and done the trepanning, right, with their holes drilled in their head and stuff, and just to give that a try to see if that raises their consciousness.
You know people that have done that?
Yeah, Amanda Fielding over in England and her husband, Jamie, they both, well, Amanda did that years ago.
Whoa.
Did a film on that, which I never had a chance to see. Yeah, so I've had opportunity to chat to them about their experiences with that.
So what has been the after effects of that for them? Do they regret it? Did they get anything out of it? That's so intense to have a hole put in your head.
Oh, no, I think they've actually worked out well for them. They're actually quite lovely folks, you know, very intelligent, very aware, you know, whether or not that was what pushed it along. But they all seem to think it was a very positive experience in their life.
Interesting.
I thought about it years ago when I was young. I read about it, I think, in 40 and Times. I first read about Amanda's, probably was it early High Times or something, and I always wanted to try it, but I never got around to it.
Tom, you say you're living in a psychedelic state, which is excellent. Have you always felt that way, or is this something you had to rediscover? I mean, do you feel like that's something that you had in childhood and you had to rediscover it, or is it just the way you've always been?
I think I probably thought I just sort of saw everything the way everybody else did. And I think in some ways I did, although I did have interesting sort of dream experiences as young and continuing on. But no, I would say, you know, probably it's something I think everybody experiences it, but the modern worldview has convinced us we're not in that state. Because a lot of my study sort of went to the Copernican Revolution and the different worldviews. And you look at, there was sort of experiment, somebody proposed an experiment after the Copernican Revolution. You know, they're trying to decide, well, Is the Earth going around the sun, or is the sun going around the Earth? I mean, obviously, if you reduce the complex motions of the planets in the sky to their lowest common denominator, it all seems like we're in these elliptical orbits around the sun. And Kepler showed that that actually matches the sort of interlocking of the Platonic solids. And obviously, you know, there's a base reality to that. However, everybody was experiencing that they were in the center of the universe. So there was quite a bit of discussion. Someone proposed that they was an easy experiment. He said, well, because we know the angle of aberration of water, so you can set up a sighting tube to a star, fill a tube with water and measure the angle change, and then do that 6 months later, measure the change of angle when you fill the thing up with the water. And, you know, you just measure the difference. It's a simple geometric problem to calculate the parallax. And all you had to do was figure out, do that, and you could figure out how far the stars were, and it would prove if the Earth went around the sun or the sun went around the Earth. Because if the Earth goes around the sun, the angle's going to change, right? Because it's, what, 180 million miles on the other side. So obviously, you're going to get a shift in the angle. Simple geometry. So it took about 100 years till somebody did the experiment, and that was a guy named George Bedell Airy. And he was the royal astronomer at Greenwich following Edmund Halley. So anyway, he did the experiment, and there was no angle change, which, of course, was a big puzzle, because at that time, Copernican worldview was firmly embedded in everyone's consciousness. So that's actually what gave rise to the ether drift experiments. Everybody was trying to, like, figure out, well, the light must be traveling around with the Earth, right? So if you think it out, you know, just think of the sun going around the Earth and thinking this light coming from the star is actually getting dragged with the ether of the Earth. That's what they were trying to figure. And of course, they could never measure the ether they wanted, so they came up with relativity, which actually doesn't make really too much sense. So I was actually trying to think this all out, and I'm thinking, well, God, yeah, I was sitting in my garden in California and meditating. I was going, I wonder what it would feel like if I was in the center of the universe. And then all of a sudden, I just realized, you know, it's like the trees felt alive, clouds in the sky, birds around, everything was alive. I go, God, it would feel just like this. I am in the center of the universe, and it was at that point I understood what Rudolf Steiner meant by the anthroposophy, or the anthropocentric point of view. You know, the center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. It's where the higher intelligence is. There is that space. And then further reading through, like, Gunter Voxmuth's Etheric Formative Forces in Cosmos, Earth, and Man, he actually shows a diagram where the geocentric and heliocentric worlds interpenetrate. They're both real. Not one's right and the other one's wrong. They're two different types of space. So what we experience every day, our biologies or our biological beings react as though we're in the center of the universe. And the complex motions of the planets, the sun, moon, and the planets, like Venus, makes its five-pointed star over 8 years as a golden ratio. And that Venus pattern is then woven into, like, apples and papayas and things, or certain flowers. There's a whole school of thought called cosmological botany, which is buried somewhere within the anthroposophical movement. You don't see too much, but I've got some books on it. So anyway, I started thinking this out, and of course, I was always studying all these other worldviews at Borderlands. You know, got everybody's viewpoint was put to the fore for discussion. So we're looking at, what was it, Koresh, or on the inside of the Earth. The cellular cosmogony, that's it, where Earth, a concave sphere, where we're on the inside. And most people go, what, are you nuts? I go, well, you might be thinking about that, and I'm willing to consider that. But what I started doing is going through these different worldviews and putting myself into that framework and just trying to believe them as a meditative exercise. And I would try to find anchors in reality that would give me reason to consider that. So Koresh, right, he showed, like, if a boat sails over the horizon, you don't really see the sail go down. You see the whole thing disappear into the horizon line, because the horizon line at sea level is 2 miles, but the curvature is 6 miles. So it takes up to at least 12 miles before you're going to really see a boat, like, disappear. But it's gone within the horizon line before that. So he did these experiments on the shores of Lake Michigan back in the 1890s, where he built this big thing called a rectilineator, forced a mechanical line for 6 miles. And so if we're on the outside, it's going to go out in space. If we're on the inside, it's going to hit the Earth. And sure enough, it hit the Earth. They reproduced the experiment a number of times. People go, oh, well, he didn't build the thing right, and this and that. And, oh, maybe he didn't. But I've never had a satisfactory answer. And if that was the only thing I wouldn't consider it. But then we look at, you know, a lot of the top secret work done by the Nazis. They had ships in the South Atlantic trying to take pictures of the American ships up in the North Atlantic. And then they had a infrared telescope up on the Baltic island of Rügen, up where they were trying to take pictures of the British fleet in the North Sea, you know, using some sort of infrared cameras. Of course, they say it didn't work, but we've known, you know, they wouldn't show us anything if it did. But here it is. You're in the middle of a big war, all this war effort. And you know how German scientists are. These guys are pretty precise. They're not going to be clowning around, like pretending they're on the inside and putting major resources into global tests of this. So they had reason to believe it. So it's a belief system. It doesn't mean it's true. It means it's a belief system. So in my categorization, that was sort of my next belief system past the geocentric. And then when you get to that point, like Steiner said, that with, you know, reality is not 3D. People call it 3D, and we can use a three-dimensional coordinate system to interpret things. But like a cylinder is only two dimensions. You know, you can calculate everything with the radius and the length. So you don't really need, you know, three dimensions for that. And Steiner said the gravest error of man's descent into matter was the removal of the Cartesian coordinate system from our proprioceptive subjective nature to objective nature as a metric of space. So in that sense, how does space operate? And that's projective geometry. And in projective geometry, the only real things are point, line, and plane. And a plane at infinity, a sphere at infinity is a plane. So is we curve in, do we curve out? Doesn't matter. It's a plane at infinity, so it's a plane. And on that plane are working the four dynamic forces, which are, you know, we could look at them as element or ether. And that's what I try to delve into in my videos, as I use those symbol patterns to kind of awaken consciousness to these higher states. So ultimately, we're in the center of the mandala, and all this is sort of projected around us. So which one's real? Are we on the third rock from the sun? Are we in the center as our biological systems relate to? And so do plants. You look at plant tropisms and stuff. There's no doubt that plants think they're in the center of the universe. You know, their shapes even conform to planetary motions as they appear from Earth, and as they were related to those particular planets in ancient herbology. So there's a lot to it. And then when I was realizing all this, which actually took a couple of years for all these pieces to fall into place, and I realized, well, God, this is the four worlds of the Kabbalah, which I'd studied as a teenager and kind of went off. You have your archetypal, which is the mandala, generative, which is the geocosmos, you know, the cosmic egg. You have the formative, which is the geocentric or anthropocentric, which is everything's forms, that formative world. And then the manifest world, which is the physical planet circling the sun in space. I think once you kind of get an understanding of that, if that's not psychedelic, I don't know what is. Yeah, you know, it's not like I see like patterns floating around things. I don't, you know, see things that aren't there, but I can see the interaction of higher forces weaving things.
Well, Tommy, this might get into your question. You had a question about ether specifically, and Tom uses that word a lot, and I've used that word a lot in my work too. So maybe what's your curiosity into that?
Well, I had a simple question that was just simply to describe ether. And I also, you know, I think what we were just hearing from Tom talk about, it's leading me to think about asking him to describe a little bit about his knowledge on archetypes and kind of our innate, kind of the innate symbols that are within us, just to hear him speak kind of generally about archetypes.
Oh, certainly. Well, ether and archetype kind of work together for myself. And of course, there's a different sort of, certainly different concepts of the ether. The ether that the ether experimenters like Fresnel and Oliver Lodge and all those fellows were looking for, they were looking for some sort of hydromechanical ether that would actually get dragged around by matter. So if we look at, like, you know, Fresnel, he had these big, long, sort of U-shaped glass tubes that they'd have water flowing through, and then he would split light. And, you know, so the light, one side would be going with the flow, the other side going against the flow. And they're trying to see which one was pulling the light beam which way. It was a couple hundred years ago, but they had very refined sort of experiments. Or Oliver Lodge, he had these big granite turntables floating on mercury that they would spin, and then they would have what they call the optical drafts with, you know, bouncing light, you know, in crisscross patterns across it, you know, with diffraction gratings, and trying to see, you know, if the light was being pulled any which way and whether west, north, south had anything to do with it. So that's one sort of concept of the ether. I'd say Tesla's concept of the ether was it was like totally solid, but it wasn't in motion. So we didn't notice it because we were all in motion. So we were kind of out of phase with it in a sense until you know, you could build up a resonance and draw from it. Steiner's ethers, you see the ethers used a lot in different occult systems, but I found the ones from Steiner's work, the anthroposophical ethers, as I call them, to probably be the ones that conformed archetypally to my understanding of reality. And this gets into like Goethe's theory of color. Newton was incorrect that when you put light through a prism, it doesn't break into seven colors. The prism forms four colors. It forms a red, yellow, and a blue, violet pole. And when you bring them together in white, you get green in the middle. When you reverse that situation and you bring the two poles together in darkness, when you run light around an object rather than through a slit, and you get magenta in the center. But fundamentally, you have the red, yellow, blue, violet. And those are the same colors as attributed to the characteristic patterns of the four ethers, which are warmth, light, tone, and life. And they correspond respectively to fire, air, water, and earth. Except that fire and the warmth element are sort of the same thing. That's the connector between organic matter in the higher realms. And we can think of that in that, like, you know, our ego is based on our warmth body. So if we get too hot or too cold, right, we lose our ego, right, because we die from, you know, too much heat or too much cold. And Steiner used the example of, like, beehives, where bees actually buzz their wings at certain angles to maintain the temperature of the hive, because, you know, the whole hive is the whole ego in itself. It's a singular ego. But then we look at, like, organic matter, like a piece of wood. You know, the warmth ether bounded together as a life force, as well as the other ethers shaped by the light ether and things as it gets more complex. But when it burns, the ether is released and falls up, you know, and that's the most powerful force. You know, what's left on Earth is just ash, some minerals, but obviously the most dynamic part of that wood causes the flame. And we think, well, it's a flame, whatever it's burning, it's gone. But if you look at it from the anthroposophical point of view, you know, that is the most important thing. That's the binding force being released back up a levity. Levity is the opposite of gravity. I don't want to get too deeply into that. But we look at the other ethers, the light ether, which is where light was the first intimation everybody had of the ether, and a lot of thoughts came from that. So that seems to be a dominant one, even though it's placed in sequence there. And then there's the tone or chemical ether, which controls atmospheric flows, barometric pressure. The Earth sort of breathes it in and out, and that's where the barometer goes up and down daily with that. And the life ether is contained in the Earth element. And we can see this in, like, Reich's bion experiments, you know, where he, like, autoclaves sand to, like, 2,000 degrees and keep it in sterile conditions. And these bionic vesicles, which would form into protozoan and type of entities and stuff, would come out of them. And following on that sort of line, there was a school of thought back in the 1800s of people that proposed that life is spontaneous. So when you see like moss or algae coming off of a rock, it didn't like come from somewhere else. That's the rock breaking down and actually converting. The life is coming out of the ether, so to speak. And that would tie in with Reich's bion experiments. So as far as their archetypal nature, Steiner sort of showed, and others, Günter Wachsmuth, they showed how these patterns, these ether formed certain patterns, which are the archetypal structure of nature itself. So in a simple form, just let's say you look at a fire. You have like a, you know, a little wood fire going, and you see the flames are caused forming like a triangle. So there's your yellow triangle, which also is like you see the rays coming off the sun. That's the pattern of the light ether. Whereas the warmth ether is like radiating red sort of spheres. You can see that coming off the bottom of the fire. You can feel the radiant warmth. So just by looking at fire, you can see the archetypal pattern of light and warmth both together there. And then the pattern for the chemical or tone ether is sort of like a vortex or a sine wave, because that's sort of how it affects. And Trevor Constable, who I worked with for many years and published his works on weather engineering, and he was chief radio officer for Matson Lines, I remember discussing with him, there was a wonderful gentleman by the name of Larry Spring, who up in Fort Bragg, California, came up with this theory that electromagnetism was traveling spheres. And he had all kinds of great experiments to show it. I still have his 4 gigahertz ping pong ball somewhere. And I remember asking Trevor about that. And he's saying, well, of course, he said, it would seem that way because these electromagnetic waves are transmitted through the chemical ether, tone ether, and that's got that archetypal shape. So it is going to seem like you're transmitting spherical shapes. And then life ether forms in kind of like crystalline squares and things.
That factored into the technology they built too, right? So this is kind of the origin of what's called like shape power, or maybe what the ancient pyramids, if they were a technology and not a tomb, kind of what they might have been based on, where they are giant capacitors, static storage devices, or in the case of Trevor Constable's work, it actually, moves clouds or something like that. And another, this dehydration system, this, I believe he's German, and I'm forgetting the name off the top of my head, but it basically dehydrates basements and it just sits there thing. It requires no input power. It's purely seems to be manipulating the charges in the water through just its geometric presence. So am I correct in that possibly some of this is more speculative than others? Like, I trust a lot of the work that came out of your camp, whereas I hardly trust much that comes out of others. So maybe you'd like to speak on that.
Yeah, well, the dehydration system sounds interesting. I'll have to do some looking on that. I'm not familiar. But yeah, there is definitely a relationship. The ether archetypal shapes work dynamically into living forms. So you see them interacting. And I can't say I'm an expert at this, but I've got quite a number of books by people that I do hope to keep on studying as I grow older, towards the phenomenology of the etheric, where they discuss these sort of patterns and how they work into certain plants and leaf shapes and things. So you can see, so it's not a single ether working it. They're working dynamically, and that's why you get all the different shapes. But basically, those shapes work into living things. But it is correct, and I would guess, or not really guess, but I can see where it would be related to the form energy, say, of pyramids, which I've experimented with mostly when young. Also, and then having seen Trevor Constable's geometric orgone accumulators, which are basically capacitors, which needed motion to work or water flowing through them. But then when he finally went to just sort of like the, cone shapes and things like that, they had to be attached to like a ship or a car or airplane or something and be moved through the ether at a certain sort of, direction.
It's just like Schauberger, right? Like his device is largely functioned on some kind of rotating apparatus. So there was always motion and a very specific vortical motion associated with his devices. So in the same sense, he understood that principle that it's about the shape, but it's also about the motion. It's about the process. It's not about, that's kind of one of my gripes with Platonism is it smacks of absolutism. So we're moving towards these things that we can never change. But I see constant novelty in the world. The way we interact with them almost changes the reality. Not completely, it's not the secret. We don't control everything, but there's like more of a relationship there. And that's why I gravitate towards your idea, because it seems to remedy that, and that it admits there's an absolutism to things, but there's also this process and dynamism and constant novelty that nothing is ever the same twice. So we don't have to worry about falling into fatalism and stuff.
Oh, correct. There is definitely novelty, and especially in, I would say, the evolution, transformation, and metamorphoses of consciousness, evolving over time. But yet I still believe that within all that, there's going to be an archetypal structure always functioning that has to be a necessity. I remember having this discussion with somebody years ago about, I was trying to explain Goethe's theory of color, and he's going, it doesn't matter. The sky could be purple. It could be this. It could be that. It doesn't really matter. It's just the vibration. It's a wavelength. I'm saying, no, there's a certain fundamental archetypal structure to the way these things operate. And I said, you're coming from the orthodox scientific point of view, believing in this wavelength theory. I said, but, we can actually show where the colors have wavelengths, but that's not their absolute. And when it comes to atmospheric color, it's certainly not the wavelength which is causing the color. It's the interaction of light and dark in the atmosphere.
And I think it's obvious when you look at living beings or living just living nature and how it responds to ordered geometries and how we as humans recognize ordered geometries innately. Without any training, we know which musical notes layer on top of each other and sound right. So I think in a way that's an obvious thing to realize.
Oh, true, true. No, I believe that once you start seeing these patterns, you start seeing them everywhere.
Yeah.
And and I've often wondered, too, if that could be the cause of some people's like psychoses and things, as they start seeing these things, but yet they're still sort of convinced that consensus reality is, you know, the absolute and can't be changed. And therefore, you know, they have this dichotomy between their subjective experience and their belief system and their biological experience. So, you know, that causes characterological dysfunctions. But I believe that, you know, the more awake you get to these things, the more you notice. And I'm very thankful. I see more and more people coming out now, like on Facebook and things, you know, doing all sorts of sacred geometry work and correlations between sacred geometry and natural patterns. It's obviously gaining an awareness across the board around the world.
Yeah, when you look at the details of it, it seems somewhat complex at first, but when you boil it down, there's a simplicity there as well, as far as just how we relate to it naturally, which I think is kind of comforting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I feel very comfortable. That's why I spend a lot of time just going out and looking at plants and trees and, you know, watching clouds. You know, 'cause even clouds themselves have an archetypal structure, even though they're somewhat disrupted. 'Cause you go to like Luke Howard's work, I think it was roughly 1830 or something, Essay on the Modification of Clouds. And Luke was one that gave the nomenclature of like stratus, cumulus, cirrus, and nimbus. But if you look at that, that's actually, and then they further categorize that into 10 things. And then, I mean, now they've even got more, and because of the disrupted atmosphere, we're getting even like new cloud forms. But if you go back to his original ones, you see in there, he was reading directly in the countenance of nature, we could call it, you know, stratus, which is the lower end of kind of the heavenly activities, which is sort of mirroring the face of the waters below. That's why they call it stratus, because it's flat. And then at the above, we have the cirrus, which is sort of, you know, flexing off into space. And then mediated by the cumulus, which is what we would truly think of in itself as the archetypal cloud. And the nimbus being nothing more than the fourth state, where, you know, the water starts, reaches that point where it starts water illumination, as Trevor would call it, you know, the rain starts coming out. But in there, right, that's an archetypal pattern. It wasn't that he just took sort of like the modern, you know, pointer reader science type of thing, and just like Linnaeus did with his, you know, Latin categorization of plants. You know, like Goethe didn't, even though he used it, he didn't like that because he had to memorize the things. They weren't innate, you know, whereas like Luke Howard's nomenclature of the clouds was an innate pattern that you could naturally see, even though it's not so much followed anymore at this point, you know, because like I say, they've added and patched so much stuff on through meteorology by not understanding the. So those patterns are there. I believe, you know, like I say, space isn't 3D, but there is an underlying metric. And that was what I learned, like working with Eric Dollard at the Integratron on the Tesla transmitter when we were burning sort of tree shapes and river shapes into wood. And he used to say, this is the nature of space. Wherever energy dissipates, it forms these patterns. And the closer the energy is to living form, the more alive it looks. So that's when we look at a plant. It is. It's the discharge of an energy into space. You know, it's a biological energy with a chemical structure discharging. So, and it's mobile, you know, as far as being able to bend. Obviously, you're not mobile like we are, but, you know, the thing can move. So it's not, space isn't rigid in that sense, but space naturally breaks into these sacred geometric patterns. Mm. It's a fundamental nature or metric of space.
Hey, Tom, maybe you can elucidate a little bit on, say, okay, I have two angles I want to go, and maybe you can address them both if you remember or not. So the first is, okay, so geometry, what is the geometry that we're actually surrounded by in society? Is it meant to keep us locked in a certain pattern? I mean, you see this hinted at in The Hobbit, for example, or The Lord of the Rings, where J.R.R. Tolkien says near the end of the book, the forces of Mordor force all the hobbits out of their round dwellings into square factories to subscribe to the time of the schedule and the agrarian calendar and all this stuff. And so their lives become toil, and their whole symbolic world changes as what they're forced to do changes, and so on and so forth. So it's meant to kind of reinforce a certain social engineering agenda almost. So do you see like geometry being used as almost like a psychological weapon against people, I guess, is the first question.
Okay. Well, the answer to the first question is simple. Yes, of course they do. You see, you know, fundamentally, everything's being reduced to a grid pattern. And it's not only geometry, but it's characterization of space, because space is taken as three-dimensional and vast and going off. But you do see it. I don't notice it anymore because I don't really watch TV, but we used to really notice it in California years ago, and we used to discuss it. All these sort of like grid patterns that would appear in commercials. We go, oh, there it is again. Look at it. You know, we started noticing it. There was always this XY grid pattern, you know, the two-dimensional thing, you know, whether it would be like a countertop or tiles or whatever. I haven't watched, and they may have progressed, but certainly archetypes are used. And as we know, I mean, you take things like the swastika and the Mogen David, which are actually the same symbol. They're like two polarities of the same symbol. Like as the solar energies unfold in the mandala, that's the swastika. And as I've understood the symbol through the way I've sort of re-engineered the reworked the Vajrayana in correlation with Steiner's ethers, you know, the six-pointed star actually is the mandala with, you know, the green and magenta, you know, if we're putting the color circle on it as being the quintessence coming out in its physical and spiritual forms. But those two natural polarities of living form, which actually constitute our makeup and the world around us, are used as very divisive psychological things, you know, as symbols. You know, people react, put a swastika up, you know, people like freak out and stuff. You know, you put up, like I've got a Star of David on my business card. Not my business card. It's because I don't do any business, but you know, just my contact card. And I have the Star of David, which is, you can find on spectrochrome.com, because I developed it out of my work with Dinsha Gaudiali, spectrochrome color work and how I related it to Goethe's theory of color. So I've got this whole color circle on my thing, and I hand people my card and I go, oh, are you Jewish? I go, no. I said, that's actually a universal symbol there. But I see the people's reactions to it, both positive and negative. So absolutely, these things are used as psychological weapons, without a doubt.
And real quick, just to interject, Alan Moore, one of my favorite authors, I'm sure he's not the first to say it, and I often give him credit for things that he's just taking from other people. But he mentions that in a great documentary, he defines magic as really, for the longest time, it was really the manipulation of symbols to change consciousness. And then our Disney pop media world turned it into something that it really never was, historically speaking. So people aren't even realizing that we're actually, society is almost a giant ritual in and of itself. And then all the little ritual plays within it where, you know, the two towers are brought down in the same fashion as Solomon's temple and this, all this stuff, you know, whether it's synchronistic or planned and somewhere in between, it keeps playing out over and over and over again in all these different situations. Now you have something like ISIS and those world events. And so they're always entangled. And I don't care to get into the conspiracy side of it because I don't really care anymore. But at the same time, it's still interesting to see how the more we change, the more we stay the same. So humans have never shaken that ritualistic side of themselves, that shamanistic side of themselves. We're haunted by it every day. And it's really our rejection of it that I think causes all the psychosis. At least that's my take on it. So yeah, you totally answered the question. And my second one was, what is the connection for you between like ether, quintessence, and music? So often you hear from older philosophers or old texts that the world and the universe is more like an instrument. And nowadays we say, oh, it's a machine and you're a robot and everything is meaningless. So I guess, how do you make that connection between music and ether? And also, what is the benefit to seeing the world musically versus seeing it mechanically?
Oh, right. Well, I think it definitely is working musically in that sense. I'm probably not the best to explain that. You should get on your show sometime, my good friend Michael Thoreau. And I believe he could probably give you an excellent in-depth explanation of that. Michael, I worked with at Borderlands for many years, and he took over as director when I moved to New Zealand. And he is a master musician and understands all of that. He can explain the difference between just intonation and equal temperament and, you know, the natural tunings and how that relates to reality. So that definitely does relate. And how exactly that would relate to the ether structure, I couldn't actually give you an answer on that right now. I know that Dinshaw gave sort of a musical scale, which was different chords that sort of fit around the Moog and David of the different colors as he had proposed them in his system. But I never really studied that too deeply. But it's certainly there. But hey, something popped to mind when you were on your other thing, and I thought I'd just bring it up because, you know, there's that whole series going on now about the Curse of Oak Island. I'm actually in touch with some of the people that are up there doing the doing some of the research on Oak Island, looking for this buried treasure. And somewhere just a couple of days ago, I stumbled across this interesting website where they're actually questioning the whole thing and claiming that there's a lot of hoax and stuff to it. But the interesting point I was going to make is what this guy says, this whole thing about digging the money pit. And he goes back through and he shows how the story sort of changed and all these different things at these different levels. He said it actually is this whole Masonic ritual of going in and finding the tomb and digging in the temple. I saved the site to go back and read later. I didn't do it, but I thought, well, that's a fascinating take. He was showing that a lot of the story that they're telling about digging down and finding these certain layers and all that's not entirely accurate as far as the history of the island goes, but it is entirely accurate as far as following Masonic ritual. And this stuff was sort of interposed on top of it back in like the late 1800s. So it's actually these things are definitely used all over the place. And also, too, I was going to say, too, about space, you know, because everybody thinks space is three-dimensional, you know, just space goes off to infinity forever. And you find that sort of in, let's say, Star Trek. You know, like Star Trek first started. I mean, that was pretty cool, you know, Spock and Kirk and McCoy and all them. You know, they'd meet some pretty amazing different intelligences. It was quite interesting. But, you know, as the show sort of degenerated, it turned into, you know, I called it the communist generation with Picard. And then, Deep Space Nine, which was nothing more than, like Yugoslavian border wars out in space. It really degenerated to that point. And, everything, and you look at all the outer space stuff now, there's no like real grand, you know, nobody's finding utopias or higher worlds or anything. Everybody's finding like these horrible beings that just want to chop you and eat you and do all this stuff. It's like space is really dark and evil. In that archetype, and it's really heavily promoted through all the science fiction. There's no real higher, really beautiful sort of worlds people are going to where everything's amazing and all this amazing knowledge is there. It's just, where's that? So I think I do believe that's probably partially intentional and also then self-reinforcing because of the modern worldview is so off from reality and so out of touch with the higher forces. And by higher forces, I mean the ethers themselves. And Rudolf Steiner wrote the book, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. And when I first got a hold of that, you know, I'd been through a lot of theosophical stuff and channeling of all these different people from here and there. And I was expecting something like that. And I didn't really get what Steiner was on about. And it wasn't until I really kind of came upon my own four world theory through, you know, experience and meditation that I realized, right, the higher worlds are all right here. It's not some far off thing. It's this higher sort of space that we exist in. I think that if people can get into that space, then we'll start to see a shift in these underlying archetypes, which are definitely holding society back as maybe a self-perpetuating ritual, we could call it.
That makes perfect sense to me. Absolutely.
Well, just one comment on what Tom was just saying. You know, I think the media has a lot of responsibility to open people's eyes to that thing and to the things that you're saying about, you know, utopia within and even the utopia without. So in space or within ourselves. So I love that challenge to whether it's authors, filmmakers, illustrators, painters, any of them who may be listening to look into those worlds. But I wanted to just ask you if there's anything new that you've got going on.
Yeah, well, basically, the next phase of what I'm doing is, and I actually came up with this when I was in South America last year. I was on a ayahuasca vision with my friend Dennis McKenna, who I met here in New Zealand when he came through a couple of years back. Basically, I wasn't really having, I wasn't talking to Madre Ayahuasca or any entities or anything. I guess I was seeing pretty pictures and puking. And so I started sort of meditating. So I started constructing the mandala in my mind. And for the last few years, and actually for quite a long time, I've been trying to connect. You know, in the Vajrayana, they have what's called the skandhas, the aggregates of consciousness, you know, form, perception, cognition, volition, which make up the four stages of the mandala, which I deal with in both of those videos we mentioned earlier, Quaternity and Dorje Blessing. I'm trying to refine that as the fundamental archetype. But that was the old school one of the Tibetans. And I've been trying to merge Steiner's ethers and Goethe's theory of color. And I kept feeling it all fit together. And I've actually got here pages of notes where I've got these two systems lined up in circles and I've got lines drawn around trying to make a match and nothing fit. It was always like some loose ends. It didn't work. So anyways, I was up in Peru doing this meditation. And so I constructed the mandala and then all the pieces were there, fit perfectly, absolutely perfectly. And I actually couldn't figure out what I got wrong. It just made so much sense. I had to come back to New Zealand and go through my notes to go, ah, that's why. And part of it was because like in the mandala of the Vajrayana, the Hani Buddhas of the Vajrayana, you know, it goes blue, yellow, red, and then green for the sectors. In the yellow sector, Ratnasambhava, the gift-giving jewel, I always thought of that as air, but it was attributed to earth always, except you read like Giuseppe Tucci's works with Theory and Practice of the Mandala, which are such a muddle, they're not really even worth reading at this point. But that's why I could never figure out these attributes, so everything was coherent. And that's because in the tattvas, you know, the Muladhara chakra is basically yellow. It's not red like the rainbow ones of the New Age, you know, because it's earth element. It's yellow like yellow sand or dry clay, you know, earth without water is where the symbolism comes from. And that's why they attributed that to yellow, because it's yellow. But then I realized in this meditation that was actually the light ether, right? So I've actually been able to merge the elements and ethers, and it coheres all the different points and puts the Eastern and Western systems into a simple mandalic form. And that's basically what I'm working on now. I'm working on a presentation sort of workshop thing, which I'm doing just to evolve the idea enough to put it into video form. And hopefully when I get done with that, maybe I'll go get a job or something. I don't know. Because I don't make any money or anything what I'm doing right now.
I think that makes all of us, Tom.
But Tom, that's basically where I'm going. I kind of have a vision of how all these things fit together. And I'm trying to basically piece that together in a coherent form so I can transmit it, because I feel that'll give people the opportunity to experience higher states, let's say by watching a 90-minute video.
Yeah. So it's the next in the series.
Right. And potentially the last, because I was going to do three. I was going to do one on light and color, one on the mandala, and one on the four worlds. And then last I did Dorje Blessing. It was 10 minutes. I was going to take like a week or two to do it, and turned out to be 20 minutes and took 3 months. And I realized the amount of time it takes to do these right. So I thought, I figured out how to compress all three of those videos into one, and because they're all the same archetype expressed in different forms. So, hopefully that might be the last thing I do on this, because I won't need to do anything, I hope, after that. I'll see what evolves, and I'll just go back to gardening or something.
Well, you know, my last question, I guess, is, you know, Tom, you've accumulated so much knowledge over the years, and I would say so much perennial wisdom, and you express in such a humble way and a non, you know, you're not trying to push any agenda. It's just you're saying, hey, these are some of the conclusions I've come to, but you're able to juggle all these different points of view at the same time while still saying, hey, I kind of lean in this direction. And so I guess my question to end is, what advice would you give people in how to pursue knowledge, or kind of how to just pursue a path generally? Not any specific advice about do this, do that, just how should you, I guess, approach growth and knowledge and how those two things are compatible with each other?
Oh, that's a good question. And it's actually hard maybe to answer without sort of giving some direction on a path, because this gets into sort of my theory of knowledge, which I don't know if it's truly a theory of knowledge, but what I consider. And that's that people say, well, how can you remember all this stuff? And I'm not really sure. But the thing is everything fits a category. all these things I do, everything fits a certain archetypal structure. And I read one book that Trevor Constable directed me to called Man or Matter by Ernst Lehrs. It's still in print, but it's also online. I've published it online. And what that does, it's basically how to develop Goethe's methodology of spiritual gnosis of the manifest world of living beings, you know, how we can basically understand things. So I would guess the main thing is just to be practical. And when you get into these alternative sciences and you're looking at them, I always take Trevor Constable. He said his motto was only results count. You can have all these theories, but if you go out and you work with something, I mean, if you're an artist, it doesn't matter. So if your path is art, I would say just look towards nature, you know, try to merge heart and mind together, you know, live in balance, you know, try to find that which, you know, because I always say art, you know, modern art, they say, well, it's self-expression, you know, which means people literally crap on canvas and they call it art these days and they get grades in art schools on it and stuff, you know, like you're throwing those people out of class. If I was the art teacher, you know, to me, art is the expression of something greater than the artist, you know, something's brought through so that, and that's what makes people think. So yeah, just open yourself up to the forms that you see in nature. You know, you don't have to believe in any spiritual stuff that you can't see. To me, the spiritual, I see it in all living beings. I see it in the sun. I see it in the blue sky. I see it in the stars at night. It's around us. It's not anything separate from us. In spiritual systems and religious systems, when they try to separate you from things you can directly experience, that's where the control comes in, because then you're subject to somebody else's interpretation. So I suppose, yeah, for final answer on that, allow your own interpretation from your intuition. Listen to all perspectives. Perspective is a great teacher. And as I've learned, my four world theory, the only reason I even came to that was because I went on a path of, after going through Borderlands and looking at all these different inventors and all their different kind of archetypal structures that they use to create their inventions, I realized I had to be able to put myself into a belief system and totally believe it. Even if I knew it wasn't true, I'd still be able to create that system in my mind for perspective. And I found that which interpenetrated the different belief systems were the archetypal keys of knowledge. I guess that's what I've learned in my almost 60 years.
Brilliant. So, Tom, thank you again for being with us and spending this hour with us. It's been a real pleasure. And Thomas, do you have anything to say?
No, it was excellent. I just eye-opening, and I've had shivers at times, and I smiled a lot. So thank you so much for the conversation.
Oh, well, thank you both, John and Tom. It was really good speaking with you both, and I look forward to doing it again.
All right, Tom, thanks again. I'll talk to you later.
All right, be well. Best regards.